From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about monkeypox, how it's spread, and how to stay safe from infection. We'll tell you about the Wisconsin town of Lake Ivanhoe and why it's being recognized as a historical marker.
And there was no fighting in the community. There wasn't even traffic in the community. Only a few cars when people came home from work. This was a very small community then, so you couldn't have found anything better.
Plus, we'll tell you about an organization training doulas to support Black and brown mothers in a system that can often feel unwelcoming.
Black and brown women are fearful, so having a partner with you, a partner who has experience in childbirth, experience in breastfeeding, and also knows the medical system is very important.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here's today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Monkeypox is the latest disease rocking our community. The outbreak has quickly spread around the world, and while numbers remain low in Wisconsin, concerns are growing as more people become infected. But unlike COVID-19, monkeypox isn't a new disease. And while there's still more to learn about the current outbreak, we are already familiar with ways to decrease the spread and protect ourselves from getting infected. Dr. Mary Beth Graham is the Medical Director of Infection Prevention and Control for Frederick Hospital, and she joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to share more about monkeypox.
I know you've been getting a lot of different questions about monkeypox, but what are the symptoms? How do you know if this is something you've contracted?
So usually, when we look at a variety of different types of infectious diseases, we look at two parts of it. Number one, are you at potential risk for this infection? So the epidemiology and also the symptoms of presentation. The classic symptoms of presentation with monkeypox that have been described and what we saw in 2003 when we had the outbreak in the Midwest, the majority of symptoms that people have are usually a onset of potentially fever in a number of patients, could be some sore throat, could be swollen lymph nodes. And within a few days, typically 2 to 4 days, the onset of skin lesions. And the skin lesions then will follow a very classic progression from a small, flat, what we call macule, to developing all the way up to what are referred to as larger pustules, which then crust over. And after crusting over, scabs will fall off, and then new healthy skin will be left underneath. Most of the skin lesions are not symptomatic early on. Those flat macules usually don't cause any symptoms. It is as they progress and become larger, and depending on where they are located, people can have symptoms from them. And also will potentially have continued fever early on in the course of disease, but then that usually goes away as the disease progresses. The time frame from the time somebody has the onset of symptoms, and not everybody has that fever at the beginning, to the time when the scabs fall off, there's healthy skin underneath, that entire time somebody is infectious. And that time frame can be anywhere from what's published as 2 to 4 weeks, but for most people, it's anywhere from 3 to 4 weeks. So think of it this way, a bit different than when we look at things like chickenpox or zoster. We tell people once your lesions are crusted over, you're no longer infectious. With monkeypox, you are infectious until those crusts are totally gone and there's healthy skin underneath. So a much longer time of being infectious.
So what are the biggest risk factors for contracting monkeypox right now?
Based on this current global crisis that we're seeing, is the people who are most likely at risk, that epidemiology at risk for monkeypox, are those who are known to have had a sexual partner in the past 14 days who is diagnosed with monkeypox, or who attended an event or a venue and had close intimate contact with several individuals at that venue, knowing that monkeypox was being spread or knowing of other individuals. Even if you did not have a sexual encounter with somebody at that venue who had known monkeypox, if other individuals at that venue are known to, then those individuals would be considered at risk.
Now, this gets to really how monkeypox is spread. There has been, I don't want to say it's misinformation, but there has been this idea floating around that it is specifically caused by sexual contact, that it's some kind of STI that is specifically affecting LGBTQ people, but that doesn't really bear the reality of how it spread.
I 100% agree with you. So the issue is the predominant way for this current outbreak is through sexual transmission. However, we know from previous outbreaks of monkeypox, we know from Africa where monkeypox is endemic, that monkeypox can spread in other ways. It can be spread by contact with infected clothing or bed sheets that somebody may have slept in. So if you have somebody with active monkeypox with active lesions who slept in a bed, if somebody else is around those bed sheets, there is a potential for spread there. The question of animals. In Africa, one of the most common ways monkeypox is spread is thought to be from handling infected animals. The exact animal reservoir for monkeypox is not known worldwide. It's thought to be some type of rodent in Africa. When we saw our cases in 2003, we knew that it was associated with prairie dogs that had been around African rodents. We don't know if other animals could potentially become infected with this. I mean, I tell people, one of the CDC guidance is, if you are known to have monkeypox, you should isolate yourself, spend as little time around other individuals as possible, or if you need to, make sure that you're doing due diligence to not have skin-to-skin contact, to not share anything in terms of like bedding, eating utensils, et cetera. But they also recommend staying away from your pet during the time that you're considered infectious. So the reality of this current outbreak is the majority of individuals are being identified as being infected through sexual contact. And the majority of individuals who have been identified are in the LGBTQ community. But you are exactly right. That is not the only way potentially that it could spread. But people need to understand, if you are in a risk group for this, to then take additional precautions to protect yourself. One thing about monkeypox is people may not recognize it early on, because what we found with this current outbreak is that when the lesions start, they're not symptomatic. They only become, again, symptomatic as the disease progresses through those stages. And depending on where the lesions are, and usually the lesions start out at the place where somebody was exposed, where that skin-to-skin contact was. So that could be in the genital area, that could be in the mouth. I mean, there's a lot of places where those things could potentially start. You may not notice it until further on in the course of the disease.
As you've mentioned, monkeypox is not a new disease, and there is a vaccine already on the market, but supplies are pretty limited right now. Tell us a bit about this vaccine and what the rollout is looking like here in Wisconsin.
It's a two-shot series. The first shot, the second shot in 4 weeks, and people are not considered fully vaccinated until another 2 weeks after that. So it's not that you get a vaccine today and you're protected tomorrow. It is about 6+ weeks after the first shot is given that somebody could be considered potentially vaccinated and protected. But again, as we know with many types of vaccines, we don't know for this one whether it will be 100% protective against monkeypox. It has been used for different orthopox viruses, and there has been a fair amount of work done with it. But again, would still recommend people, in addition to if you are in those risk groups, and the risk groups specifically put out by the state of Wisconsin are those individuals with a known sexual partner in the past 14 days who were diagnosed with monkeypox. The second is a person who attended any event or venue where there is known monkeypox exposure. And the third is gay, bisexual, trans, or any men who have sex with men who have had multiple sexual partners in the past 14 days. That's straight from the state of Wisconsin alert. Those individuals would be eligible for vaccination. They do recommend contacting your primary care provider, who then could connect you with the places where the vaccine could be administered. This won't be available at your local Walgreens. This won't be available at your local pharmacy. The vaccine is going to 5 hubs in the state of Wisconsin and then being sent to very specific sites from each one of those hubs. Similar to what was done early with the COVID vaccine, where it wasn't widely available because of the limited supply.
All right, well, Dr. Graham, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you.
Dr. Mary Beth Graham is a professor of medicine and surgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin in the Division of Infectious Diseases and the medical director of infection prevention and control for Frederick Hospital. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Lake Ivanhoe, about an hour's drive from Milwaukee, has a rich and little-known history that's about to be recognized as a state historical marker. The town acted as a safe place for Black families to spend summers during an era when racial tensions and segregation were increasing in Chicago. Peter Baker first visited Lake Ivanhoe on a fishing trip with his grandfather. His family moved to the community soon after in the 1960s. Baker showed WUWM's Susan Bentz around the town and shared a bit of its history.
This is where we came through and we launched the boat at. Until today, I remember everything about it. I remember exactly where we fished, and pretty much to the spot, but it would be right over there. And you got to understand, for a 12-year-old kid coming from Chicago, a major adventure. And at 11 years old, my mother would literally bring us down here with our tent, and we'd sleep down here all night with a flashlight at 11 years old. And I got a dog, and I turned him into a hunting dog, and fishing rods, and friends in the community, and there was no fighting in the community. How could life be better? You know, there wasn't even traffic in the community. Only a few cars when people came home from work. This was a very small community then. So I think for the boys and the girls, you couldn't have found anything better. Yeah.
So where were your parents both from originally?
Well, they were from Missouri, basically. Mm-hmm. But with her involvement in the civil rights, when I came home and I said, Mom, we were up there and this was a Black community. Just the thought of a Black community, because there's nothing, we didn't hear of anything like this. And so when I came home, I said, Mom, it was an all Black community. And she had been fired from the Chicago Board of Education by Mayor Daley for leading one of the largest protests for the double shifting of African Americans or Blacks at the school I was going to, Cornell at that time. And she had to drive out to Chicago Heights to teach. She couldn't work in Chicago anymore. And she hated that drive. She got caught in a snowstorm one day, she just was not a person that really loved driving. So I think it was a combination of things. My mother was also, she enjoyed the outdoors. So a combination of all that led her to believe she had to come up and see this place. She said, Ernest, we are going to go up there next weekend. And he got in the car. They had trouble finding it. They finally found Lake Ivanhoe because there was no GPSs in. And literally they saw for sale signs on houses and they put money down that weekend. We went back home the next week. They came up, signed the deal, and the following 3 weeks from there, I was up here playing every weekend.
How many families do you remember growing up? Was Lake Ivanhoe filled with families?
Yes. Every home was basically a home of young people then. There were some elderly people here. Maybe the kids had moved off, the Stewards and Tom Sawyer and them. Their kids weren't there, but they still had nephews and nieces or grandchildren would come up. But every house... There were 13 African Americans at Badger in the year that I was there. I don't know if that was my freshman year, because more might have came in the next year. But however it went, it was an average of either between 7 and 10 at Badger. It was a unique experience. We would go into Lake Geneva. By junior and senior year, with ability to drive, we did have friends that we would go and visit sometimes and hang out with. Even though everything really basically stayed out here in the community.
So when did you start learning about the very beginnings of Lake Ivanhoe?
Well, my friend Judith had written that article.
So your childhood friend wrote this report.
Yeah. Right, listening to the elders. So they told her this story. She wrote this report. And one of the teachers told Samuel Gonzalez that he needed to look at it. So he reads it over and he goes, wow, this is interesting. With this being his college thesis, he did it correctly. So he went down and talked to the families. They brought out the pictures and showed him.
So when you were a kid, were you aware that your friend had done this report?
No, she was in eighth grade when she did the report. By that time I was...
You were busy with other stuff.
Right.
When did you make the connection?
I really started with it about 98. So here's what happened. I called and told him, could I have the paperwork? And I read it and I said, the story has to be told. And so I had my daughter, she was proficient enough to do a PowerPoint. We had the pictures to go along with the speech. I don't remember all the places. I would do it anytime anyone would ask me. We drove up to Madison and did it at the Wisconsin State Historical Museum or Society. Uh-huh. And there was probably 8 people in the audience and 3 friends that I'd rode up there with. So that's when it started, and that was in about 2003 or 4. From there, people began to be curious about it. Different historical groups would come out, and I would talk to them. I did it at the school, and I can't think of all the other places.
So was your goal all along, did you have this plaque idea in mind? Is that what you
Once
wanted?
Once I found out about it, I knew it was historical.
Yes.
And as soon as I saw, and I don't remember the first historical marker I saw, uh-huh. It could be the one where the train stopped in Lake Geneva, or I could have read something. All I knew is that this needed to go. I could have got information when I gave the speech at the Historical Museum, but yeah. Nobody, you know, that would have been one place that I thought would have said, wow, you know, you need to take this to the Historical Society and do something with it.
But your experience has been you kept talking to people, telling the story. You ultimately heard from the Historical Society.
The past 2 years, I'm guessing year. About.
There is now special funding, and the focus is let's make sure that we reflect the rich Black history of Wisconsin.
Of the minority history of Wisconsin.
Yes, yeah.
So they're looking, they've neglected every minority in Wisconsin.
Yeah. And how long has there been an association?
1944, they started the Wisconsin Lakeside Property Owners, and then 2 years later they changed it to the Lake Ivanhoe Property Owners Association. So that would be 1946.
So that was in order to bolster that strength.
I'm guessing that helped to bolster that strength.
Yeah.
It became a bona fide community with a property owner's house to protect the community, yes. To bolster the strength of the community and to protect it. Yeah. So, and believe it or not, it's still here. It's amazing. And the fact that we keep this open and have Halloween parties for all the children out here, Easter egg hunts for the children out here. Of course, we enjoy it socially. We have football, you know, Packer Bear game parties, and we do special events for, you know, the community. Just, we used to have Lake Ivanhoe Day. We used to have everything going on and set up volleyball nets and everything else and put in the horseshoe pits.
You've made your life here. You're a builder. You've built here in Lake Ivanhoe. Yeah. So you really feel like you're part of bridging that history, and you want this community to live on.
Continue to grow. I definitely want it to live on, because I want to live in this community. So for as long as I can, this is, I'm hoping it works out that way. I love this community.
Peter Baker is a Lake Ivanhoe resident. He spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. In about 15 minutes, we'll tell you about a program in Milwaukee that's working to train more doulas to support Black and brown pregnant people throughout their pregnancy. But first, comedian Tig Notaro joins us for a conversation about her Hello Again tour. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tig Notaro has been a stand-up comedian for decades. Her comedy style and career exploded soon after her 2012 Largo set, where she announced that she had breast cancer days after her diagnosis. Her ability to find and share humor in a pure deadpan style has led to many accomplishments, including 2 Grammy nominations for comedy albums. But Notaro's career has expanded far beyond the stage. She's produced shows including the semi-autobiographical One Mississippi, starred in movies, and also hosts 2 podcasts, one called Don't Ask Tig, and the other, Tig and Cheryl, True Story. Notaro and I spoke earlier this year ahead of a show in Milwaukee. So I'm going to start us off perhaps a little unconventionally, but now that you're traveling with your Hello Again tour after not being able to with the pandemic, I'm wondering if there's something you did not miss about being on the road now that you're back at it.
You know what I didn't miss is the occasional bad mattress in a hotel. That's what it is. But aside from that, I do enjoy touring. I love bringing new material to cities. I love finding a great coffee shop. I love finding plant-based food. And there's usually like friends or family in different cities that I can see. So I, of course, miss my family. But I guess that's the other part that's not great.
Mattress and family. That's good ones. So how do you feel the pandemic has impacted your relationship to performing stand-up? Have you felt like you can just kind of get back into it like muscle memory, or do you approach it differently?
I was concerned about it at first, but I was a little surprised that it all kind of came back. And I really feel I'm at a really great place with it. And yeah, I'm excited about it all over again.
So obviously during lockdown and beyond, parenting and surviving were, I'm sure, some of your main goals. And you've also worked on film and television during this time. So has it been a difficult shift to get back to stand up, or are you able to kind of compartmentalize pretty easily which jobs you go back and forth to?
I think, yeah, I'm so used to compartmentalizing my all the different elements of my career. So yeah, it was pretty easy to just slide that back in.
So on a recent episode of Don't Ask Tig, you were speaking with Deepak Chopra, and he said, quote, "As soon as we define ourselves and our title, we limit ourselves." So, you know, for the majority of your career, you've been known as a stand-up comedian, but over the past few years, I feel especially, you've reached more and more audiences through different film and television projects, podcasts, of course. So would you agree with Deepak, or what would you consider to be a more accurate title, or how do you prefer to see yourself in your work?
I mean, I think I fully identify as a comedian, but I did like when he said that, because it just kind of made me think about, you know, I think about with comedy when people ask, oh, what kind of comedy do you do? And as soon as you tell them what kind it is, they might decide, oh, I'm not really into, you know, personal stories, or I don't like deadpan, or I don't like, you know, whatever it is. So I do think there's an importance and strength to not limiting yourself with titles like that.
Well, and I think one key example of how your comedy is sharing yourself and can be intimate in its subjects is, of course, the Largo show, where you talked about your cancer diagnosis in 2012. So how did you frame or approach your new show, Hello Again?
It was really just, you know, there wasn't a huge amount of thought that went into it. It's really stories and experiences and observations that that I was excited to tell, and, you know, figuring out the best order and way to string them together. And I'm really, really having so much fun doing this show. And I really wanted it to be nothing more than just a fun, funny show. And I am calling it Hello Again for, you know, obviously coming back after the pandemic, but also There's also another reason why it's called that. And I always encourage people, please come to the show and find out for yourself why it's called Hello Again.
Well, people will have the opportunity this coming Monday. You'll be here in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. But to touch upon the note of podcasts a little more, your last big podcast project was Professor Blastoff from 2011 to 2015. So I'm curious what went into deciding to dive into the podcast space again in making Don't Ask Tig and Tig and Cheryl True Story.
Well, Cheryl and I had talked about doing a podcast before the pandemic, and we had met at my house just before lockdown. And then it just seemed like a natural transition to like, well, here we are. We have this time on our hands. And so we just got into it. And then Don't Ask Tig just came up after several meetings with APM, American Public Media, who produce it. And it just felt like, I mean, I love doing podcasting, and it just happened to all fall around the beginning of the pandemic. And it was such a great way for me to reach my fans and be able to be funny and creative, but also stay home and be safe during such a crazy time.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of listeners turn to your podcast as a way to decompress and laugh, especially over the course of these past couple of years. So do you view your podcast as a form of decompression for yourself? I mean, obviously, it's, of course, still work and things go into producing the show, but I'd love to hear how your relationship or perspective of podcasts has changed since you started getting into them earnestly again.
Yeah, I would say more so, there's just the one that I do with the Tig and Cheryl True Story. I mean, it's been such a huge, I mean, they're both so fun to do, but Tig and Cheryl is so off the rails, ridiculous. And it's truly decompressing doing that show, but they're both so fun in their different ways. Because with Don't Ask Tig, I get to talk to a different friend or celebrity or, just some person that interests me each week. And, whereas every week with it's just me and Cheryl, every now and then we'll have a guest, but it's very rare. It's just the two of us catching up on a documentary. But we oftentimes barely talk about the documentary. So that's yeah. The decompression.
Absolutely. Are there any types of questions you particularly enjoy or segments of Don't Ask Tig that you love to dive into? You know, like Name That Thing or Confession Booth. Are there favorites?
I really enjoy the Advice of Yesteryear, where we revisit an old advice column from like the early 1900s or something and try and give a better answer. And it's always so fun and interesting to hear what people were going through, how not too much has changed, but the way people spoke and wrote back then, it's so fascinating to think of somebody responding with that sort of way of speaking. But also the advice that was given is so crazy, so crazy. And the questions are so, I guess it still stands today. The questions and answers are still so crazy.
Yeah.
Not always, but they're out there.
Is there one that stands out in your mind for anyone who's not familiar?
Anyone from the Advice of Yesteryear?
Yeah, like a situation from Advice of Yesteryear where you're reading, it's like, wow, what a question.
Honestly, they all kind of blend together because I feel like it's always like, dearest, you know, Gretchen Dixon, I come to you in the wintertime of 1905. And you know what I mean? I'm like, what on earth? How is it that somebody is really writing like this?
Yeah. Now we've limited ourselves to how many characters, I suppose.
Yeah.
For Don't Ask Tig, is there a guest you'd love to have or any kind of bucket list guest that you're trying to work through?
Oh, I mean, I kind of got one of my biggest, and that was Esther Perel. I just really, really love her. And but there's not really... anyone like that to me where I'm like, oh my gosh, if I can get this person, I feel like I've gotten so many incredible guests, and there's just an ongoing list of people equally as interesting. And I don't know.
So amongst your many projects, you also had a documentary. It's on Netflix right now. But one section of that kind of stood out to me. You talked about how the hype after your Largo set went viral and how that stressed you out. And you've obviously continued to grow and work, and not just in your stand-up, but, you know, recently we've all experienced the hashtag hot tig via your role in Army of the Dead. You got other TV projects and film projects. The hype keeps coming, essentially. So how do you feel about it or deal with the hype now? How have you grown in that?
Well, the hype is always a fun surprise and curveball that happens. But I don't feel like I have to deal with the hype anymore. Whereas before, I felt like I was in such a vulnerable place in my life, physically and emotionally. And there were a lot of people and opportunities coming at me, and they were a lot of times very interesting, and I wanted to do them, but I was in a weird place and I didn't know how to sort through everything. It was just very overwhelming. Whereas now, you know, it just feels more like, oh, well, I don't have time for that, or I can move that to another time, or, you know, I don't, my life is so different now, and I just don't feel, I think when I feel overwhelmed, I kind of know how to put the brakes on it and sort through.
Amongst your work across many platforms, that of course comes with fans from lots of the different places converging. You know, say someone might know you more strictly for stand-up versus someone might know you from Star Trek or films. So how do you view your connection or relationship to your fans as you've expanded to different audiences?
I mean, when I get on stage every night, I truly feel like I'm hosting a party. And at every party, obviously, there's going to be someone who's into Star Trek. There's going to be someone who's dealt with cancer, either personally or through their family. There's going to be somebody that's gay. There's going to be somebody from the South. You know what I mean? It's like, I just, that's really how I feel, is I'm having a party, but I'm usually the only one talking.
And everyone's having a great time, though.
I hope so. You know. I mean, you know, sometimes there's a weird night where it's like an entire theater's like, that's okay. But I would say in general, yeah, everyone's having a good time.
Have you had a meh night since returning to it? Did it hit harder, like post-COVID, and you're so excited to get out, and if you don't get that feedback you're looking for, it's...
I mean, it's not even about post-COVID. It's just as a performer, always wanting to do my best, and then you can't kind of, you can't figure out why it wasn't as explosive of a feeling or night as it was the night before. And but I think that's just the way comedy is, or any live performance. You just have sometimes a show that didn't hit as hard.
Moving from your live performance aspect to a lot of other production aspects. So for example, you recently co-directed the film Am I Okay with your wife, Stephanie Allen. And while it's not the first time you've worked together on projects behind the scenes, you know, it is the, correct me if I'm wrong, is it the first time you've directed a film together?
Yeah.
Yeah. So how has that experience fed you, you know, professionally, personally, emotionally, all the ways? How did you find that experience?
Well, I love working with Stephanie. She and I very much feed each other's creativity. Oddly, I mean, people are always like, oh my gosh, what was it like working with your spouse? Or, oh my gosh, if I worked with my husband or my wife, it would be, you know. But we prefer to work together. And there have been times where we've shown up on different jobs and the other one isn't on that job, and we'll text each other and or call and say, God, I wish you were here. And that's not to say we don't have our issues and we're not, you know, dealing with life or family like everybody else. But in general, I absolutely prefer to work with her because we have such similar sensibility, and the way we play off each other or build off of each other's ideas, we really complement, I think, each other and whatever it is we're working on. And so I just feel so lucky, and I hope that we can continue to not only be together, but work together.
Tig Notaro is a comedian, actor, writer, and podcast host, to name a few of her titles. We spoke in March, and you can hear more of the conversation at WUWM.com. Did you know that you can listen to Like Effect as a podcast? If you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, just search for Like Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your podcasts to hear us on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Like Effect interviews. Coming up, we'll tell you about a program working to improve outcomes for Black and Brown pregnant people. That's next on Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Black women are 3 times more likely than white women to die of pregnancy-related causes. In Wisconsin, Black women are 5 times more likely, making the state's Black infant and maternal mortality among the highest in the country. Locally, the We Rise Community Doula Program is trying to change that. The program is working to train more people to become doulas who can support other Black and Brown pregnant people. Doulas are not medical professionals, but are people who provide guidance and support to pregnant people before and during labor. Dalvery Blackwell is the co-founder of the African American Breastfeeding Network. She joins Like Effect's Mallory Chang.
Here in Milwaukee, Black infant and maternal deaths are significantly higher in comparison to white babies and maternal deaths. And right off the bat, how is the We Rise Community Doula Program bringing awareness to this in our city and state?
This project, the We Rise Community Doula Program, we work with community-based doulas. And as we know, doulas offer critical support throughout pregnancy, childbirth, and postpartum period. And they are essential to the health and well-being of all birthing people and mothers. So the work that we're doing is really important in the community. We usually meet the mothers while they're pregnant, so that we can develop relationship and build trust with the families. And so the doulas work with them while they're pregnant. They help them with the birth plan, for example. They review with them some of the ideas they have that they wish for their birth and experience. So it's really important model that organizations, not only the African American Breastfeeding Network, organizations across the country are using community-based doula models to improve maternal and infant health.
And you just mentioned that there is an importance of increasing the number of community-based doulas to help with the high infant mortality rate within Black infants and maternal deaths. Could you talk a bit about that? What is the benefits and what is the power in having a doula with you throughout your birthing journey?
Yeah, so unfortunately, we have reached this point in America history where Black and Brown women are fearful of birthing in a hospital setting because of the history of being not listened to, seen as invisible, the maternal mortality and morbidity rates that we all are experiencing and know about. So Black and Brown women are fearful. So having a partner with you, a partner who has experience in childbirth, experience in breastfeeding, and also knows the medical system is very important. The relationship helps build trust between the birthing person and the doula. Some of the benefits, we know that when women birth with the doula, they have a better experience overall. They're more happier with their birth outcomes. They initiate breastfeeding and tend to have exclusive breastfeeding rates. They connect better with their providers. They're more likely to have that postpartum visit with their doctors that is so necessary for care. So there's so many benefits when mothers birth with a doula.
Yeah, and like you mentioned earlier, the We Rise Community Doula Program is a part of your organization that you co-founded called the African American Breastfeeding Network. What inequities did you and your co-founder find initially, and why start a community doula program under this umbrella of the African American Breastfeeding Network?
We started the African American Breastfeeding Network 13 years because we saw disparities in breastfeeding and inequalities. Black and brown women were not initiating breastfeeding 10 years ago. They were not even trying to breastfeed in the hospital. They didn't have breastfeeding confidence. Also, there was a lack of resources to provide prenatal education around the value of breastfeeding and the benefits of mother's milk. The other inequalities that we saw, there were not Black and brown women being recruited to become breastfeeding peer counselors or even lactation consultants. Women often had difficulties accessing outpatient health care for lactation support. They had difficulties accessing a breast pump in preparation of going back to work in school. So we saw those disparities and decided to address them through our community breastfeeding gathering, which is the hallmark of my organization. We provide education prenatally to moms. Right now, virtually because of the pandemic, we provide educational services while moms are pregnant with our community-based lactation specialists. The continuum of care is birth and breastfeeding, so we felt that it was appropriate 2 years ago. My board of directors expanded our mission statement to include championing maternal infant health. And so advocating and supporting women for breastfeeding success and confidence, we also heard the voices of the women who wanted to have support while they're in labor. So I also had a doula during my first birth, so I know the value and the experience of having that person there by your side and guiding you and supporting you through the processes, but also honoring your own birth desires and wishes, for example. So we just felt that the expanding our mission statement to include having community-based doulas to serve women made a lot of sense. We also have a program called Healing Waters because, unfortunately, birth doesn't always end with a baby. Sometimes, unfortunately, mothers and families lose their babies. So we have a program called Healing Waters. It's a bereavement program for families to help them cope through the bereavement journey.
And Dalver, you mentioned earlier that one of the main reasons why you all started the We Rise Community Doula Program was in part from your own experience of working with a doula during your birthing process. Tell me a bit about your story with collaborating and working with a doula. Why was that important to you and what was that experience like for you?
It was important to me because I was a first-time mom and I didn't know what to expect. And my birth experience was important to me and I wanted to own it, meaning that I wanted to do certain things, like I wanted to eat during my labor. I wanted to use water. So I started to study doula-assisted births. My daughter is now 20, so 20 years ago. And I can honestly say after birthing with a doula, I know I would have had a C-section if she had not been there. The second thing I would say is I read many books. I listened to different people. I looked at videos, and nothing could have prepared me for my first birth because I never experienced birth before. Having a doula there, she was the person who coached me and give me encouragement and praise and have me walk around, for example. She would ask if I could eat. She allowed me to advocate for myself, but she also advocated for me.
And the We Rise Community Doula Program in itself has been doing a lot of work within the community in training and working with certified doulas and training people to become doulas. And in last year's state budget, Governor Tony Evers tried to get doulas covered in the state's Medicaid program. However, that did not pass. And right now, only midwives are covered under the state's health insurance plan. What would the impact be if doulas were covered by the state insurance? What would that community impact be?
When we see the state Medicaid program supporting community-based doula work, we see a partnership that is necessary to improve maternal infant health. And what we will also see is a focus on truly removing some of those systemic barriers that prevent mothers from having positive birth experiences. For example, if Medicaid would cover doulas, their pay would be increased, for example, and organizations like mine could provide supplemental pay that would be matched with the Medicaid reimbursement. That's one result. Another is extending the postpartum period longer for doulas to work directly with their clients. So right now, we can only cover the doulas through our funding postpartum period 2 months. When there's legislation and policies initiatives throughout the state and through Senator Tammy Baldwin's office to extend postpartum care up to 12 months, which is so critical when we're working with families that have just delivered babies. We know that that postpartum period is a very critical period for mothers where they may experience postpartum depression. They may need more support with baby care. They may also have questions regarding their own mental health and their own personal health.
Definitely. And you all work at the African American Breastfeeding Network and the We Rise Community Doula Program, have been working with state and local and national partners to change the reality of doulas being covered under state insurance, state Medicaid insurance. How is the African American Breastfeeding Network trying to create an open access to doulas so it's not only affordable to clients, but also is a sustainable career for people who want to become doulas?
I'm glad that you asked that question. My organization is really important that we support working women and that we support women in the birth space because doula work, in my opinion, is priceless. The women, it's not a 9-to-5 job. The doulas are available 24/7 for their clients. And so one of the ways that we're supporting this space is by collaborating with the Department of Health Services. We have a pilot program in which we're looking at prenatal care coordination and doula services and how to integrate the two. And at the same time, lifting the voices of the women who are doing this work, the people who are doing this work, so that we can understand what their concerns and issues are. The most important issue right now is equitable reimbursement, paying for the services that the doulas provide. So typically, a doula would meet her client while she's pregnant and provide support and help connect her to community resources. She might attend a doctor's visit with her. And then she also, in our program, in the ReRise Community Doula Program, we request that the doula stay with the mom once she's in active labor throughout her labor. And that can be sometimes 15 to 20 hours. And also the women in the ReRise Community Doula Program or the doulas, they provide postpartum support up to 8 weeks. I think it's very important that we continue to lift and honor the birth space through community-based doula model. I think in this space that we're working in and with the disparities in the maternal mortality and all of the other health issues that Black and Brown families face, the community of doulas it's important that they build the framework of collective work and responsibility so that they see this issue as something that they can actually help, not solve, because doula-assisted births won't erase maternal mortality, right? But it could aid in improving the health of mothers and children and families.
Yeah, all of that is such important work within our Milwaukee and Wisconsin communities. Thank you so much, Dalvery, for being here on Lake Effect. I really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Dalvery Blackwell is the co-founder of the African American Breastfeeding Network. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang in April. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Mallory Chang and Joy Powers join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Kate Flynn and Chase Browning. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayan Silver and Susan Benz from the WUWM News Team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valerio Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast from Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.